Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, Denny Griffin here, and welcome to Meet the Author. And before I introduce my guest, I'd like to give out our call-in number. If anybody would like to call in with a question or comment for my guest or for me, you can reach us at 646-478-0982. That's 646-478-0982. And if you're listening through my homepage on Blog Talk Radio, you can also text message your questions through the chat room if you're signed in. So either way, contact us if you have any questions or comments. Tonight, my guest is Joanna Campbell Slan. Joanna is the author of several nonfiction books, seven of which are specifically on scrapbooking. In 2004, Joanna founded a contest for scrapbookers in the United Kingdom called the Best of British Scrapbooking, which still runs today. And in 2007, she co-founded Sisters in Crimes Forensic University of St. Louis. Joanna lives with her husband David and son Michael in a suburb of St. Louis, along with their two dogs. But tonight we're here to talk about, not necessarily about Joanna's scrapbooking books, we're here to talk about her debut mystery novel called Paper, Scissors, Death, a Kiki Lowenstein scrap and craft mystery. Joanna, welcome to Meet the Author.
Thank you, Denny. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad you could join me tonight. We've got several things I'd like to cover with you this evening. And first, when we were talking off the air, you told me that you'd recently been to an event, a scrapbooking event. Can you tell me what that was about?
The name of the event is Scrapfest, and this was the fifth year for it. It is put on by Archivers, which is one of the largest, well, I think it's probably the largest solely scrapbooking chains in America. They have 45 stores, and their flagship store is at Mall of America. And so each year they host Scrapfest, and this year they invited scrapbookers from all over the world, and they had 10,000 scrapbookers there. And I guess there's a group from Iceland that comes every year, Denny.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a pretty good trip to come to. I mean, they must be into it heavy. Huh? That's quite a trip over.
Well, those of us who love scrapbooking refer to it as an addiction.
Okay.
And I guess the folks in Iceland, we could say, must definitely be addicted. And I was told that what they do is they bring big empty suitcases and fill them with scrapbooking supplies to take home.
Oh, wow. Your book had just come out then, your new book, in time for this event, right?
Yes, in fact, my publisher, Midnight Inc., was kind enough to make sure that we would have copies before the event. And so we were able to premiere the book at the event, and we sold 300 copies.
Wow. What a nice way to kick off your book.
I was pleased, and I can tell you that my publisher was pleased, too. But I think that that's just the start for this book, because since then, a lot of the scrapbookers have been emailing me. They've already read the book. They got it. I guess it was, let's see, the event started on Friday, so they many of them were driving home or were flying back, and I've been getting emails from them, and they've loved the book. So if they love it, it'll do well.
Absolutely. Before we get into to the new book, can you tell us a little bit about your other books, your scrapbooking books and other things you've written?
Sure. I'm the author of 10 other books. The first book was a college textbook. It's called Using Stories and Humor, Grab Your Audience. It's produced by Pearson Group, which used to be part of Simon & Schuster. The book is one in a series of books for people who want to do public speaking. It's been endorsed by Toastmasters International, and Benjamin Netanyahu's speechwriter has told the Israeli press that it's one of his favorite resources. It's a book that explains how people can find personal anecdotes, shape them, and use them when giving presentations. Two of the books are inspirational books. They are personal essays. I'm one of the early Chicken Soup for the Soul writers. I appear in five of their books, and one of my stories for their books was used as a TV program on the PAX network. And so I have two books. One is called I'm Too Blessed to Be Depressed, and we sold 15,000 copies of that. I hand-sold it, and I self-published that, and then Adams Media picked it up. And then the second one in that series is Bless This Mess. And then I have seven books on scrapbooking. The first book on scrapbooking came out in 98. It's called Scrapbook Storytelling, and we sold 85,000 copies of that one.
Wow. It's I never realized that scrapbooking was that big, as you call it, an addiction, but apparently it is. I mean, it's just phenomenal numbers.
Well, the scrapbooking industry is a $3 billion industry, and I think that that number is wrong. I think that it's a very low estimate because it doesn't include some things like computers and cameras and travel to events and things like that. One in every three to one in every five homes in the United States has a scrapbooker in the home. Not only is scrapbooking big here in the United States, but it's huge in South Africa. It's big in Australia. And I was there to witness the birth of scrapbooking in Europe and especially in England.
Now, your new book, The Paper Scissors Death, you combined scrapbooking and your knowledge of motherhood and a plot, a murder mystery. And so you're on familiar turf when you wrote about the subjects, not the murder, but the scrapbooking and the motherhood.
I am a mom, and I know that most scrappers get into scrapbooking because they're a mom. So I was familiar with that for sure. And because I set the scrapbook murder here in St. Louis, I was able to, I think, illustrate the area that I live in, because St. Louis is a quirky little place. I felt that St. Louis hadn't been used to its fullest extent as a setting, and so I made it my goal to try and exploit the town and some of the things that are unique to St. Louis within the book. And then, of course, being a mom, I was able to use my knowledge of, in this case, the private school system. St. Louis has more private schools than Chicago does, even though Chicago has four times the population. There are 120 parochial schools in St. Louis, and that doesn't, of course, cover the other schools. Those are just church-run schools. So having been a public school kid myself, I found that that was a different world, and I was able to use that. What I found was that there were things in my life that were unique, and I think every writer probably has those. I just didn't really realize it until I got to thinking about them and to sorting them out. And so I used those unique touches, I think, to make an interesting backdrop for my book. But as you said, I did not research the murder, although I did learn a lot about poisons while working on the murder. And I did go through the county jail, and that became really useful because one of my copy editors had a question for me. There's a scene that takes place in the county jail. And the county jail here in the St. Louis area is unique. There is a white stripe that's painted along the floor, and the detainees are told that they are not to cross that white stripe. And believe it or not, Denny, they stay on the side of the stripe.
They do. So when you went to the jail for that part of the research, they were receptive and cooperative?
I was really fortunate. I'm the president of the local chapter of Sisters in Crime, and at the time I started writing the book, I was the program person for the local chapter of Sisters in Crime, and this is why volunteerism is so important. I hadn't really thought about having a scene in the jail, but some of our members did want to see a county jail. So I contacted the gentleman in charge of the county jail. I think he's a corrections officer. I think that's his correct term. His name is Jerry Kramer, and Jerry was kind enough to give members of the chapter a tour of the county jail. And, you know, Denny, there is just no substitute for being in a place physically, because you pick up the smells, you pick up the sense of the place, and it was really helpful when I went to write those scenes.
Yes, I remember reading the scene you're talking about, and I was intrigued about that white stripe. You know, it was nothing I had I didn't know that they had any place that type of an arrangement. So I was very interested. I used to, years ago, in fact, I worked as a deputy sheriff, and I started out working in the jail. So I have a little, although it's been years, background with how jails are run. And I was very interested in that particular section of the book. Now, your characters. Kiki, who I really liked, does Kiki have some of your characteristics and traits?
Yes. I confess. I do. Kiki and I are a lot alike. I wish I could lose 10 pounds, Denny. I probably never will. I have naturally curly hair. She does, too. I look younger than I am, and so sometimes people don't take me seriously. I think that Kiki and I are alike in that I've been known to apologize to grocery carts that I've bumped in the grocery store. But we're also alike in the fact that we're kind of like the unsinkable Molly Brown. You can knock us down, but we're not going to stay down for long. And we have an incredible sense of loyalty and love for the people in our lives.
Yes, that came across, I thought, in Kiki's personality. Now, how about some of your other characters? Did you just make them out of whole cloth, or are they based, at least to some degree, on people you met or people you know?
I did base them on some people that I know. Often it was an amalgam.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Being a writer, there are words that I can spell and I can type out, but I have no idea how to pronounce them, Denny. But yes, there are people who are a collage, that one I got, of people that I know. For example, Mert, who is Kiki's best friend and her former cleaning lady. Mert's kind of a hard scrabble girl, and we had a cleaning lady a lot like Mert. I remember when this woman applied for the job, she was sucking on a cigarette, and she turned and she looked at me and she said, "I got a vacuum cleaner that can suck up a bowling ball." And I remember thinking to myself, man, oh man, this lady is something else. And then Mert said, I know, how can you not hire someone who could suck up a bowling ball? Well, I think the way she pronounced it actually was "sook," which I thought was fascinating in itself. But Mert also drives a particular truck, and it's one that I saw one day at the grocery store parking lot. On the rearview mirror, there is a dead ferret hanging over it, and draped over the ferret is an American flag and then some Mardi Gras beads. So there are things that really I couldn't make up, Denny. They're just too wild and too weird. Dodie, who is the scrapbook store owner, she doesn't look like any of the scrapbook store owners that I've met, but Dodie is a very hairy woman, and I've noticed that some people have a tendency to kind of lean forward and walk on their toes, and that's Dodie's like that. So What I try to do is file away in my mind things about people that are distinctive, and then I haul those out for my characters.
Well, I must say you did a very nice job. Your characters are very realistic and believable. And, in fact, I was wondering if you know any of the same people, because I know some people that are like your people. Maybe we met some of the same ones over the years. Now, you mentioned the plot itself. I don't want to give too much away, but... the plot itself, is that anything you were familiar with, or had you heard about that type of thing happening?
Are you asking
you know, about how the murder took place? And...
Are you asking me if my husband is cheating on me?
No. nothing like that.
Because I can assure you that after learning all these ways of poisoning people, I think my husband would never even entertain any ideas about that. Also... as part of my research, I learned to shoot a gun, which is one of the things we did at Forensic University. And it turns out that I am naturally a very, very good shot. And that also gave my husband a lot to think about, Denny, believe me.
I can imagine. Yes, it would. That would be an attention getter.
I think that the way that... Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Okay. I think that the way that the plot is like my life is that I think that sometimes I have undervalued myself, and I think that that's a very normal thing for moms to do, and Kiki does that. I think another way that the plot is like my life is that, as I said, I grew up going to a public school in Little Vincennes, Indiana, which was the home of Red Skelton,
mm-hmm.
if you remember him.
Oh,
and
yes.
So when my son went to this, he was admitted into this very exclusive private school here, that was a culture shock for me. I had never rubbed elbows with people who had buildings named after them. And so I used that sense of what it was like to be an outsider in a private school culture, and I brought that into my character, Kiki. And then, of course, Kiki loves to scrapbook, and anyone who knows me knows that I love to scrapbook, and I have more than my share of scrapbooking toys.
I was just, I would be remiss here if I didn't let people know how to contact you if they're interested in your book or any of your scrapbooking books and so forth. Let me give them a chance to get a paper and pencil, and then in a couple of minutes I'll ask you to give out any information, such as a website or that type of thing. That'd be okay?
That'd be great.
Okay. Now, when you transition from your nonfiction, your first 10 books, into the fiction, what did you find different? In other words, in the way of publishing options, if there were any differences in the way of marketing or that type of thing, did you notice a big difference between your nonfictions and then switching into a novel?
I think the first thing was the writing is so different, because when you're writing fiction, the universe is so big. In nonfiction, you pick a topic, and of course in nonfiction, you turn in the proposal before you write the book. So frequently your publisher or your distributor will help you make adjustments with that proposal. In fiction, of course, you're writing and you have no idea whether the person on the other end is going to like it or not. And sure, if your manuscript's accepted, you might get some feedback, but it's a much more solitary approach than the nonfiction was, at least for me. That said, I think that a lot of what you learn with nonfiction carries over into the writing of fiction, in that you learn to write choosing the best words you can. I have a degree in journalism, and before I graduated from college, I was writing a column for the Muncie Star, the local paper there, because I went to Ball State. And so I learned very quickly to edit my own work, and I learned the importance of good grammar and good punctuation and things like that. So those are skills that I think put any fiction writer out ahead, and those are useful. When it came to marketing, I learned so much from marketing the nonfiction. And it's a little bit more difficult in some ways with fiction, because with nonfiction, you have a topic, and people either like or don't like the topic. And there are people, I mean, just about every topic that you could imagine, there's someone out there that's going to be interested in it. But with fiction, it's entirely possible that you could write something and no one could be interested in it. However, excuse me, when I was writing Paper, Scissors, Death, I knew what the market was for my book. Because I had written 7 nonfiction books, and because I'd taught scrapbooking in the UK and on cruise ships and here in the United States, I knew what my audience looked like. I could visualize these women. I knew what their lives were like. I knew the tools that they used, and I was very specific. I named brand names. And at the time, I did it, Danny, because I wanted that sense of realism, because it's kind of like a code word within my industry. If I say undo, every scrapbooker in the world knows what undo is. If I say, did you grab your cropper hopper, they know exactly what I'm talking about. And those words become sort of a way of proving to them that I know what I'm about. But they wound up being marketing helps for me too.
Now, when you've had, I think when we talked earlier, you said you had books published, both self-published and traditional. Am I right on that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And from a publishing standpoint, having gone, both to the traditional and the self, do you have a preference, or are there pros and cons, or do they both have their certain benefits?
I think that they are different products, or maybe I should say they're different delivery methods and different manufacturing methods. I think that there are times when you want to self-publish and times when you want a traditional publisher, and I don't think that one is better than the other. I don't think that you should ever say, well, I would never self-publish, although that's certainly a choice that people can make. But I think that there are times when that's a good vehicle for you. For example, I was working as a motivational speaker. In fact, Sharing Ideas magazine named me one of the top 25 speakers in the United States some years ago. And back then, as a motivational speaker, you really had to have what they call back-of-the-room sales, and that was a book to sell. Well, that was fine for me because I have a degree in journalism, and I had written for the Chicken Soup book. So I gathered my essays together, and I self-published I'm Too Blessed to Be Depressed, and I sold that back-of-the-room. So my point is that when you create something, you need to think, what am I going to do with this? And when you self-publish, what you need to figure out very early on is, where is my market for this? It's fine if you want to self-publish, and what you want is not to do anything other than share it with your family. Last year, my uncle decided to self-publish through Lulu a family book that had the different genealogy things in it. It's a limited market. It was perfect for it. It was very nicely bound. But self-publication isn't the answer to everything, nor is traditional publishing the answer to everything. I have, as I said, self-published books, but I also have an e-book, and that was not self-published. That was published through a scrapbooking site, and that little book continues to generate income for me on a, I guess it's three times a year basis. So mm-hmm. I think that writers really need to know a lot about the writing world and the writing market. They need to know about the different options, and they need to think very carefully, what is my goal here? Is this for income? Because if it's for quick income, self-publishing can be the best way to go if you can raise the seed money to do your own printing and all of that, and if you have the distribution method. If it's because you have something that would appeal to a certain online market, and scrapbookers, 90-some percent of the scrapbookers are online. So my ebook was perfect for the online market. It was perfectly priced and perfectly positioned, and I have the perfect place to sell it. It's a scrapbooking website. Or do you want the cachet and the notoriety? And let's face it, do you want the sort of fame that comes with writing a novel? Well, if so, then you'll probably want to go through a traditional publisher. So it just depends on what you want, what you're looking for, and then aligning those things together.
Okay, let me, before I forget, have you give out your contact info, and then we'll get back into another question I have about publishing. So why don't you go ahead, Joanne, and give out any information you want, how people can reach you or learn more about you.
My website is www.joannaslan.com, and that's JoannaSlan.com. My last name is Slan, like slang without a G on it. And the website is my first and last name pushed together with no space between. And people can go through the website to contact me. The website also has another section that will lead them to a scrapbooking website. So if they would like to see some examples of scrapbooking, I do an online magazine three times a year, although I think we're probably going to bump it up to bi-monthly. We have a readership of close to 5,000 now, and people can sign up and they will receive the online magazine. So that's the best way probably, www.joannaslan.com.
Okay, great. Now, let me get back to publishing and traditional versus self. Would you agree with me that it's very important for the writer, for the author, to do some research, especially if they're brand new to the business, the writing business, because I had always thought that writing was kind of a benign business, but there are actual some scam artists out there in various aspects of the writing business, including publishing, the so-called book doctors, and even agents and so forth. So my opinion is that with the internet and the relative ease of doing research, that an author is not doing him or herself any favor if they just jump into something without at least trying to get some background information on who they're considering doing business with. Would you agree with that?
I would totally agree, and I would go a step beyond that. I think that a lot of times people are not going to be honest with you about where they got burnt.
Mm-hmm.
It's too embarrassing. And so I think that whenever you purchase a service, like, for example, if you are purchasing an editor or a book doctor, that you need to ask for a lot of specifics. You need to ask, how is the process going to work? What is the time frame? What can you expect for your money? What sort of recourse do you have if things aren't going the way that you expect? And I think that particularly when you're buying services for people, you should never give people the full amount of money up front. I've learned that the hard way. It's much better to break the payment into portions. That way, if you get into it and you discover that that's not what you thought you signed up for, you don't have a financial risk factor there.
Mm-hmm.
As for publishers and self-publishing ventures, there are two names that stand out, well, three actually. Dan Poynter, that's Poynter, John Kramer, Kremer, and Marilyn and Tom Ross, Ross. Those are the three big, well, I guess you couldn't call Tom and Marilyn one person, but those are the four big names in self-publishing. And if you read the books by those people, they often tell you who they would suggest that you have do some of your self-publishing if that's what you decide to go to. I think it was through my affiliation with the National Speakers Association that I found the company that did the pagination, that is laying out the pages in my self-published book. And then I used a local graphic artist to do the photography. Frequently when people self-publish, what they do is they skimp on the cover, and that immediately identifies the book as being self-published, and it often then prejudices readers against it. Often then writers will skimp on having it edited because they don't either want to spend the money, or maybe in their heart of hearts they don't want to hear what an editor would say, and that again makes for a lesser product. And then the book packaging is really incredibly important. I had a product that I'm still proud of today, and then I self-published a book a couple years ago, The Best of British Scrapbooking. That became a self-published project, and it's an absolutely, absolutely gorgeous book. It's 68 pages in full color, but I think we spent something like $20,000 on Photoshop work and on graphic work before the book was ever published. So, yes, I think a lot of people get into self-publishing and they find some place to do it and that's fairly inexpensive, and certainly the barrier to entry financially can be very low. But the question that you have to ask yourself, and Denny, I think this is a really important question, is 10 years from now, am I still going to be proud of this product? And for a lot of people, I think that a question that they aren't willing to face.
Yeah. And you can correct me if I'm in error on this, but there's, I guess, straight self-publishing, which is where you actually run your own company. I know people who have self-published that have taken on a business name of, you know, Joe Smith Publishing or that type of thing. And they publish their own book and they pay all the costs and get their own ISBN numbers and so forth. And then there are an awful lot of self-publishing service providers such as Lulu or what's another one? Author House.
A Universe.
Used to be First Post. Yeah. And they, of course, it doesn't cost as much because you don't have to buy it. In other words, these people would set up your book for you and format it and get your ISBN number and those types of things. And I know now that they've a lot of these companies also have added packages. You can get your basic publishing print book, usually print on demand. Then you can also get buy packages, like they have an editing service that if you want to pay so much, they will edit your book for you. And then they have a lot of them now are going for marketing and promotion. If you're willing to pay, you know, an additional fee, you can get the marketing and promotion package. The one thing I found that some of these companies, I'm not saying any of the ones that I just named, but there are companies out there, self-publishing service providers, that seem to publish anything that's submitted to them. And if the author submits a sloppy manuscript, maybe about an off-the-wall topic, or maybe just short of smut or pornography, these companies will basically print what you send them, and that'll end up in a book. And I think sometimes self-publishing or self-published authors get a bad name because the authors who submit a sloppy work that probably has no business being in print, and the company that they submit it to prints it anyway, and people buy that and get burned because they find all kinds of errors or what have you, and then they get turned off by self-published books. Do you think that's a factor in some of the bad raps against self-published?
You know, that's an interesting point. I'm sure that all of that's a factor. I think that the virtue of the traditional publishing route is that you are vetted several times. The acquiring editor vets your work. That person is the person who initially decides to take on whatever you've written as a project. And then typically the acquiring editor will take your book before a board of people, a marketing board, say, and they'll decide what they think about the book, and they'll give their input, and they'll all read it. For example, at Midnight Inc., there was an entire group of people that read my book, and this is before it was ever published. This was after the acquiring editor brought the project to them, and they all had input. In my case, they didn't have a lot to say. I was very fortunate that they liked it the way it stood. Then the next area is you have an editor who reads the book for content and reads the book for continuity mistakes and for mistakes in logic and all of that. And then you have an editor who reads your book again for punctuation and error. And again, I was so fortunate with Midnight Inc. because having published books before and having a background in journalism, I worked with my editor and I said, now let's decide how we're going to handle this phrase. For example, in scrapbooking, there's a phrase called make and takes. I said, shall we always call it make and takes, or shall we call it make hyphen n takes? And so they helped me put together an internal logic, an internal style book for my book and for any books that come afterwards. So think about how many people I've just named. These are all people who have looked at my book and who have given feedback, and these are people in the publishing profession. That is an entirely different situation than when you self-publish. I remember a friend of mine who gave me her manuscript to help proofread, because over the years I've become pretty good at proofreading, which still doesn't mean that I never make mistakes, but I've developed an eye for it. And it was a book that she had written on newsletters, and she had a section on proofreading, and she misspelled proofread in it. And it's things like that that if you don't have a second set of eyes, or a third set, or as I was talking about, a fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth set of eyes, those are the things that really make you look like an amateur. Even if your story's really great, those are the things that really give you a bad rap.
And so then it would be probably safe to say that going with a legitimate traditional publisher adds probably a little credibility, because people who read a lot know, or at least have some idea, that when you're traditionally published, you have gone through these various steps and these extra sets of eyes have looked at the work and so on and so forth. Do you think that's a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement, and I also think that for a lot of people, if you've never worked with an editor, if you've never been through the process of having somebody else come back to you and say, hey, I have a problem with this, or hey, I have a problem with that, or have you noticed that you use the word was every other sentence? Those are all things that, for example, when I was in journalism school, that's what I got when I turned my work in for evaluation for my instructors. So when you're working with a traditional publisher, it's like getting a PhD because you're line edited. When I teach writing online, what I do is I will line edit people and their first few assignments. I will go through what they send in. I'll go through their assignments line by line and make suggestions. Sometimes it's misspelling. Sometimes it's usage. For example, someone will spell peer, P-I-E-R, and they mean P-E-E, two E's, P-E-E-R, as in look. So I will go through what they submit very carefully, and I will give them feedback. If when they send the assignment in the second time, if they haven't taken any of those suggestions to heart, I don't do it again. But the average person doesn't have the opportunity to be line edited. And so what you're getting from a traditional publisher is you are getting that PhD of education as a writer. You are getting the value of all those people at that publishing house giving you input and giving you suggestions and giving you that critical eye. Years ago, Denny, I met Van Cliburn, the great pianist, and he told me that part of his work as a pianist is to step outside whatever he's playing, to not get too involved in the music, because he has to view what he's doing and hear what he's doing as an audience member. And I think that that's something that it's very difficult for any artist to do, is to step away from his or her work and to look at it objectively. And that's what you get when you are taken on by a publishing house. You get all that. And if you can, that's by far the best education. That's why their products usually excel in the marketplace.
Yes, I agree 100% with your analysis. Is it okay if we move on to marketing for a minute?
Absolutely.
Okay, now I'm going to fess up and admit that when I first started writing, I had a particular story I wanted to tell, so I just went ahead and hit the keyboard. And I didn't check into publishing options. In my head, I guess, at the time was when I got the manuscript done, basically the first person I sent it to, or first house I sent it to, or the first agent, was going to snap it up. I would then sit back on my couch waiting for my publicist to call me with a schedule of book signings or a tour. I made a mistake, because I had no idea that there was more to writing than writing. If you want to get into it as a business, there's a lot of aspects to it. And that marketing, no matter how good your manuscript is, no matter how good your story is, if you can't market it or don't market it, it's really of no use. I mean, nobody's going to read it, so it's not going to help anyone. And certainly from a financial perspective, if nobody buys it, it's not going to do much good. Would you say I'm right there, or was I the exception? Or do you think people need to know that marketing is a very important part of the writing business?
Well, I guess that everyone is going to come to this business of writing with their own, his or her own mind made up about what they're willing to do. But I personally decided early on that this was what I wanted to do more than anything else on earth, and I would learn every aspect of it, and I would work my butt off. And part of that I learned early on was that I had to be an advocate for my book. And I think that that's a more global term than being a marketer or a promoter. Being an advocate for my book means that when I got the back cover copy, I made some suggestions and some tweaks to it, and the young editor who did the back cover copy and I worked together. And I said to her, you know, your job is to do this and to represent the publishing house, but it's my job to work with you and do the best job I can to represent what I think the market is that I intended and to represent my story. And so in every approach that I have as an author, and my publisher, Nina Inc., has been absolutely fantastic. But I'll say to them, I've said to my publisher, or my publicist rather, I'm an advocate for my book. I will ask you for things. You are supposed to be the gatekeeper for the company. You will decide what you can and can't do, but I will always ask, and please know that I consider that my job and that I will hold it against you. So that's the way I've approached it. I guess because early on I did some self-publishing, I quickly learned what kind of a financial investment I had from self-publishing. And one of the resources I would suggest to anyone is people who self-publish have to be more marketing and promotion wise, I think. So any of the self-publishing sites often have some great tips for marketing and promoting your book. I think that's my job. It doesn't do me or you or anyone any good to write if when you write it, you hide it away. Unless, of course, that's your goal. I mean, maybe there are a zillion Emily Dickinsons out there. But that wasn't my hope. That wasn't my dream. That wasn't my goal. So I've done everything I could to learn the process of promoting and marketing my book.
So it's up to the individual then, basically, of what your goals are and how much you're willing to invest in time or, in some cases, money to reach those goals. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's even beyond time and money, Denny. I think that there are people whose personalities and egos are such that they aren't comfortable putting themselves on the line. For example, up at ScrapFest, I sat at a table, and when people walked by, I didn't just sit there with a dumb look on my face smirking at them. I stood up and I said, "Hi, I'm Joanna Slim. I've got a new book. Can I show it to you? Hi, did you hear about my new mystery? It's about a scrapbooker." And I talked my product up. I could have sat there and thought, well, you know, they're going to flock over to me. And if I had been Janet Ivanovich, they would. But they don't know me yet. And so it's kind of like going to a cocktail party and mingling. Sometimes people would just kind of look the other way and not give me eye contact. Sometimes people would just say, no thanks, and walk away. But you know what? A lot of people came over. And then I told them what my book was about, and that's how I sold it. And for some people, it's not even a matter of whether they're willing to put the money into marketing or whether they have ideas about marketing or whether they're willing to travel. Some of it is, are you willing to risk the rejection that comes with taking your product and trying to hand it to the consumer? Are you willing to engage in a conversation with a bookseller and say, this is who I am, this is my product, and if you get a reader who's looking for this, I hope you'll steer them my way? And that's a decision that each individual has to make. How much are you comfortable with?
Joanna, we're just down to about a minute, and I don't want to move on to my last question without asking, what do you have in the future as far as fiction? You got anything else in the oven? Is there anything you're working on?
Well, I had already written book two in the series when we sold book one. So that's already written, and the publisher has that. And I was told over the weekend that I should start thinking about book three. I'm working on another series now, and that's a fictional series with a little bit of a paranormal bent. And then I would like to do some historical fiction. I love to write. I love it. This is all I wanted to do ever. I've worn the letters off of most of my keyboard. So I have all kinds of projects in mind.
Good. And doing something you enjoy. When do you expect your next fiction to be out? Have you got a target date?
They're looking at June, but I hope it'll be earlier than that.
Next June, tentatively.
Yes. Yes, I hope that I can convince them to do it a little earlier because I have fans chomping at the bit, so we'll see. We'll see how persuasive I can be. Or how much
sure,
I test.
You got to keep the fans happy, too.
You know it. And, man, now that they're hooked on Kiki, I'm going to keep her coming.
Well, Joanna, listen, we're out of time already. I don't know where it went to, but I want to thank you so much. It's been real pleasure talking with you tonight and very informative. And I hope when your next book comes out, you'll keep me in mind and we'll do it again.
Denny, you're a gentleman and a scholar and a real joy. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Joanna. You have a great night and good luck.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Okay, and that was Joanna Campbell-Slan. And if you're into scrapbooking or scrapbook-related murder mysteries, you need to check out that book. And in the meantime, until my next show, have a great week, and we'll talk to you later. Bye.